Coming up on Boston Public Radio, we'll talk state and national politics, tell you shocking details about CEO salaries, not just going through the roof, but heading straight to Mars, and ask you, is this okay? Gene Rivers will give us his take on the proposed state of emergency in Boston's most violent neighborhoods and detail a new movie telling a devastating true story about alleged police brutality. ESPN's Steve Morantz on his new book about a local high school working wonders with Latino students. And then, why the 1812 Overture has become America's de rigueur July 4th anthem, even though it was written by a Russian. All that next on Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH. I am Marjorie Egan. This is Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Bruce. He's not Bruce. His name is Jim. How quickly we forget. Jim Brownie, not Bruce Brownie. He's on vacation this week. I hope he's not listening. Ably filling in is Peter Kazis of WGBH, former editor of the Boston Phoenix. Hello, Peter.
Glad you got my name right, Marjorie.
Sorry about that, Jim. Okay, we are almost a week beyond the United States Senate race between Gabriel Gomez and now Senator-elect Ed Markey. Since that election is behind us, we want to know what's next for the Massachusetts GOP as well as for Gabriel Gomez and how the 2014 governor's race will look. Martha Coakley, perhaps, will be weighing in. Join us to debate all this and a little national politics as well is Senator Robert Hedlund, state senator from Weymouth. Thanks for being with us, Bob Hedlund.
Good afternoon.
And Aaron O'Brien, associate professor of political science at UMass Boston. Thanks for being with us, Aaron.
Thrilled to be here.
Okay, now to get us in the mood to talk about gubernatorial politics, Bruce Browdy, otherwise known as Jim Browdy. Every week when Charlie Baker comes on, he comes on every Tuesday at 1 o'clock, he asks him the same question. To get us in the mood, here's Bruce Browdy and Charlie Baker.
Where are we on 2014 in the governor's race?
I've said for a long time, Jim, that sometime this year I obviously have to make a decision, and that's pretty much where I'm at.
How are those conversations going?
My wife and I are, you know, when we have a free moment, it's been interesting.
Interesting indeed. Listen, is there any chance that there could be a three-way primary for governor in the Republican Party with Charlie Baker, Scott Brown, and Gabriel Gomez? Who wants to take a shot at that?
Well, I guess being the Republican here, I'll take a shot at that. I would say absolutely no way. No way for all three, and likely no way even a two-way. I think if Charlie Baker decides to get in the race, he's the guy you'll see the party coalesce around. I know that Scott Brown's name is put forward a lot by you pundits, but to quote Rob Eno, who I think has been on the show from Red Mass Group, in a recent blog post he put up, he talked about the fact that there's a perception, I think, even among some Republicans, that Scott Brown is probably more of a legislator while Charlie Baker is more of a manager. And I think Charlie Baker, for those that listen to the show every Tuesday, know from listening to him, an extremely capable, intelligent guy that would make a great governor. So I think that's the prevailing mood amongst Republican activists anyway.
Well, the Herald had a great piece this morning, Aaron, by Joe Battenfeld and Hillary Chabot, speculating that after Gomez showing, which I didn't think was that bad, but it was a 10-point loss to Ed Markey, that the Republicans weren't going to waste their time running for United States Senate when, you know, months from now when the term comes up again. They were just going to focus all on the governor's race. What do you think?
I say no. As a good bipartisan, I really think it'll be Charlie Baker. I think Gomez had his time. And it's over.
You know, Charlie Baker is governor?
Yes.
Okay, but what about the GOP, but Senate, that they're going to give up on the Senate
altogether? Oh, I see what you're saying. You know, yeah. I mean, the problem is it was so exciting for the GOP for a while,
yeah.
Right? When Scott Brown won, that was amazing. It was national news, and there's a little bit of fatigue, right? They thought, well, maybe we'll win this for real when he ran against Warren, and then maybe we have a shot here. But I think it is time. You know, we forget that Scott Brown won because of health care was going on the first time. Scott Brown won the first time because of the angst over health care. It was the first time we had one of these special elections, and it was unfathomable that a Republican would win. And I just don't think lightning will strike twice, and Republicans know it.
But But, Bob, let me ask you, I mean, the Republican Party over the years has done very well running candidates who were unsuccessful against usually Ted Kennedy, but right. who went on to have other careers. I mean, people may forget Joe Malone,
right.
Bill Weld, Mitt Romney.
Sure.
I mean, why leave it uncontested?
I don't think they will leave it uncontested. I think Gabe Gomez has another run in him. He definitely got the fire in the belly to run. He's run for local office, and he's run now, you know, statewide. And I spent the day before the election with him, part of the day. Clearly, he's got a level of enthusiasm for public service. He's going to do something. I think he's got another run in him. Scott Brown, I don't know if he's got another run in him, quite frankly. But I wouldn't imagine that looking at the results and looking at Ed Markey as a candidate, despite the fact he'll have 17 months with the power of incumbency to try to solidify his control of that seat, I can't believe that nobody will emerge against him because, quite frankly, I think he's an extremely weak candidate. He demonstrated that he's a weak candidate based on performance and based on the amount of votes that the Democrats were able to turn out. I mean, I know it was June. I know it was a special election. You know, Gabe Gomez, not exactly the strongest candidate coming out of that primary, surprised even Republican activists
right.
by winning. And you've got a guy 37 years down in Washington who pulled less of a vote than Mark Roosevelt pulled against Bill Weld when he ran for governor. I mean,
so is it that bad?
The door is open. The door is almost shut, I will say, I will admit. But it's a jar, okay? And someone's going to look at that and say, I can take this guy. I mean, how long is the rant about the Koch brothers and big oil and the war on women actually going to carry someone
in a
statewide election again? I mean, he's going to have to talk about something of substance. He's going to have to talk about the national debt. He's going to have to talk about the economy at some point. And I don't know if Ed Markey's capable of that. And I'm not sure if he's had the water shut off in Malden or if the staging company that went and set up the house to do the interview with Fox 25, whether they left the set there for another 17 months and he's paying the freight on that or whether they emptied the house out again. I don't know. So we'll see.
That was the voice of Senator Bob Hedlund implying that Ed Markey does not really live over there in that.
Implying? I mean, it's a fact. It's a fact.
But the question,
you know,
Aaron O'Brien,
I'm going to stay on topic.
Okay.
And listen, Ed Markey is a snooze candidate. Absolutely, I would not agree with or disagree with that. However, the next question, the important question, is can the Republicans in a real election turn out for the Senate and get a winner? And the answer to that is no. Demographics don't point towards it. They lost to Ed Markey, the snooze fest candidate, when Republicans were actually motivated to turn out much more so in June than Democrats.
You know, I was struck, though, the day after the race. You know, it wasn't a surprise. I'm going through the paper and I'm not reading the stories very carefully. But then all of a sudden I saw the map inside the Globe, and it showed, you know, the
right.
blue areas around the urban and the red. And I was amazed at how widespread the vote was for Gomez. I mean, not in raw numbers, but you saw how many Republicans there still are
in the suburbs
in Massachusetts, in the suburbs
and the rural. Those aren't Republicans. In my district, for instance,
far independents.
Well, you've got. I'll tell you what. Down my region, and this is a little bit of an anomaly, but you had a lot of Democrats who supported Steve Lynch in the primary.
Yes,
they couldn't. They crossed lines in the general election. They're the same people in the town of Weymouth and other Plymouth County, for instance, and Weymouth and Norfolk County. The same people that crossed the line, party lines, in the Scott Brown race. They were there. And if you magnify that in a higher turnout election, it would have been a much more competitive race.
But that's not true in the sense that Republicans turned out a lot more than Democrats in this race. And in a normal election, when you've got
right.
down ballot races, Democrats are going to turn out much higher.
Well,
So Republicans turned out here. And it also, I think, Stephen Lynch is the best thing that ever happened to Ed Markey. While it's true some people couldn't vote for Gomez, it's also true that it really solidified Markey's support because he was just such a yawner. All the critiques that you brought up about him had a lot of people saying, God, why did this guy get the crown? And then Stephen Lynch comes in with his real social conservatism, and a lot of Democrats said, okay, I can, you know, hold my nose and vote for Markey.
Right. But the things I mentioned, the point I'm trying to get to is in response to the original question, and that is there will be a competitive race in 17 months.
Yes. I think for
against
governor.
Ed Markey. For both. Absolutely
course,
for both.
I have to laugh, sorry, Margie, about Lynch being termed a social conservative.
Right, right.
Only in Massachusetts.
That's very true.
Only in Massachusetts would Steve Lynch be considered.
But that's where he's running.
I know, but in Kansas, he'd be a communist.
Excuse me. Very true.
I think Lynch was further to the left than Gomez on guns. He's an anti-gun guy, and he would call himself, everyone called him pro-life, but in fact, he had almost as high a rating from NARAL and Planned Parenthood as people that are pro-choice. He was a personal, I'm pro-life, I'm not going to change the law kind of
and
pro-life
also,
guy.
And also, his health care vote for a lot
That's
of
true.
Democratic
That's true.
Voters. That was, listen, Obama needed those votes, your party needed you, and you saw Saudi go for Scott Brown,
yep.
And you didn't make the bold choice. So I think that was part of it, too.
We're talking with Erin O'Brien, Associate Professor of Political Science at UMass Boston, and Bob Hedlund, State Senator from Weymouth. Now, I shouldn't have blown this, and I did, before you guys get in here, because we have the all-important triathlon results from Cohasset. Scott Brown, age 54, from, of course, Rentham, who is, you know, very fit guy, weekend warrior, versus Gabriel Gomez, age 48, from Cohasset. Did you know the results of this already, Peter Cassis?
I did not.
Did Erin know the results of this already?
I just found out, and I guessed wrong.
Okay. I think we all would have guessed. Who would you have guessed? Navy SEAL. Who would you guess would win the triathlon?
Navy SEAL.
Navy SEAL.
I would have guessed Gomez, too.
Well, good for the older man in this race, Scott Brown, age 54. He finished 94th overall out of 819, finished 5th out of 49 in his division. Gabriel Gomez, 431st overall. How about that? So Scott Brown finishes 94th overall, Gabriel Gomez, 431. I love that.
I can explain that.
You can?
Okay.
I mean, think about it. Gabe Gomez just came off a grueling U.S.
Yes.
Senate race.
Rubber chicken. That's what I was going to say.
And what's Scott Brown been doing? He's been working out. He's been relaxing. He's been collecting.
He's rolling in the money.
Exactly. The hardest task he has to do is open up the checks that are rolling in every week.
How'd you do? This is your district down there, Senator Hedlund. How'd you do in the triathlon?
I had an important softball game that required my presence.
Okay. Well, let's get to the governor's race for a second. Now, the Globe reported on Friday that Martha Coakley, who, of course, is the attorney general and who was beaten, to much to the shock and consternation of many Democrats, by Scott Brown in the special election 2010, Martha Coakley may throw her hat in the ring. What do you think, Erin O'Brien?
I am dying to take this question. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Because it is such an urban legend. Now, she won't win and she won't get in, okay? But I think it's so unfair to her in the sense that she wasn't a terrible candidate.
She was not.
If we go back, I mean, she wasn't great, but she wasn't terrible. She was the Gabe Gomez, if you will. She was fine.
Oh, the Marky.
Right. But she was fine, all right? But this was the first special election that we had had. It was unfathomable that a Republican would win. It was the only ticket or the only race on the ballot. And as we already said, the healthcare fervor was so real. And so she had the perfect storm. But this urban legend has developed around her that she
what
was...
What urban legend? She
that she was
candidate?
The worst candidate oh. ever that existed, and she didn't shake a hand at Fenway, and this was hugely symbolic of something else. And so that urban legend will kill her. But I want to poke some holes
in it. Think she's going to run? You think she's going to run for governor?
I think she will, and she won't win.
You think she's going to run?
I don't know if she's going to run or not, but I do think she was a poor candidate. I mean, there were a lot of mistakes. It wasn't just not shaking hands at Fenway. I mean, I remember one event, the labor guys told me about this, where they were at a rally for labor, and after, rather than go out and shake hands, they put her in a car, and they had her drive by everybody and do a wave through the window, and that was the that
like
was the
Queen of England?
Exactly. But, you know, if you look at her career, I mean, she lost big time, I think came in like 5th in a special election for state representative, ultimately won by Marty Walsh. And I actually attended two of those debates. I had a friend that was working in one of those races for one of those campaigns. And then she just was in the right place at the right time for Middlesex County DA, which is a great path lieutenant governor. To AG. She had a wide open avenue without having to campaign for AG. She's been in the right place at the right time twice. That was really the first time or second time she was tested in a race. And both times she didn't perform when she had competitive races, both the state representative and she only had 300-something votes for state representative
in
a special.
Is, I
think she still needs to prove how good a candidate she is. And that's not urban legend. That was a bad race.
Well, I disagree there. I think she's an average candidate. But I think the trope that you've mentioned, that she was terrible, prevents her from winning in the future.
Well, there's also, I'm a big believer in election patterns and almost superstition, if you'll say. You know, when was the last time an attorney general was elected governor? Can either of you recall? I mean, I can name some that lost. Oh, whoa, they all lose.
You know why? They had that prosecutor's disease.
Well, that's what I mean.
Scott Harshbarger, Middlesex County prosecutor. Tom Riley, Middlesex County prosecutor. Both became attorney general. Martha Coakley, Middlesex County prosecutor, district attorney. They had the exact same pattern. Middlesex County AG's race, they all lost. So why do you think they all lose then?
Because they put people in jail or they sue them and take their money away.
What we do in the legislature too.
Take our money away, that's for sure.
That's true.
But it's the nature of the job.
I agree.
I mean, to be a good attorney general, and everyone you mentioned was a good attorney general, you have to be to a certain extent above a level of politics. That's not to say they weren't all political in their own way. But I think that's a big part of it. The same pattern holds true in Rhode Island, interestingly
The
enough.
Skill sets of a good AG are not the skill sets of a good meet-and-greet candidate.
Let me throw something in about the Senate race, though. Let's put on hold the question of whether she was a good candidate or not. The question, the issue was that Scott Brown was a terrific candidate.
Yes, well said.
He was a terrific candidate. Mm-hmm. And even if Martha was at her best, I don't think she would have overcome him.
We're talking politics with Aaron O'Brien, Associate Professor of Political Science at UMass Boston, and Bob Hedlund. He's a state senator, Republican state senator from Weymouth. I want to move on to some national politics because there's a great story. I know Aaron is all excited about this, and I'm all excited about it, too. The Democratic State Senator Wendy Davis, her high-profile filibuster that lasted for 13 hours fighting an abortion bill. Let's hear a little bit of Wendy Davis.
As we began to debate this bill on the Senate floor last week, we talked about the fact that we were here because we had taken extraordinary measures to be here. And I want to talk about that for a moment.
Okay, if people miss this, and it would be hard to miss because she's become the darling now, the media darling. She's been everywhere in every one of the talk shows and stuff. A really, I thought, courageous filibuster that lasted, I forget if it was 11 or 13 hours. 13 hours, thank you very much. In her little pink sneakers. She wasn't allowed to lean on anything. She wasn't allowed to get the back brace when someone intervened to give her the back brace. And she prevented the bill from being passed with massive amounts of support. Why are you so excited about this, Aaron?
Because of the massive amount of support.
Mostly from women.
Mostly from women, not all from women. And also at the institutionalist in me, and there is one, right, loves the fact that she had to actually filibuster, not threaten to filibuster. She had to filibuster. The visuals on that are so superb for Democrats. You know, the parliamentarian, no, you can't take a back brace. You know, really? And so the more Republicans want to run against a Wendy Davis in that crowd, and Rick Perry's going to go after her, you were a single mom and you didn't learn from this. Good news for Democrats, bad news for women in Texas.
Could I just ask a counterintuitive question?
Sure.
What if this had been a gun debate?
And the
hall was full of NRA members, you know, trying to howl a speaker down. I mean, didn't it smack a little bit of mob rule?
Well, 100%. I would have, and other Democrats, I think, would have been disgusted. But it speaks to real deal politics right now. It's the same way with the Supreme Court decisions, right? I personally was like, oh, they got it totally wrong on voting rights, but they got it right on gay marriage. A lot of people who disagree with me see the inverse. And so, you know, Democrats for a long time, a lot of people have felt like have been afraid to use the real deal tough politics of the filibuster, of those tough as nails tactics. And her doing so, it's bad for institutional politics at all because it's more combative. But it mobilizes the base and it gets people excited when she does it. Just to your point, as if someone was doing that for the NRA, many Republicans and especially strong NRA members would love it.
Now, Senator Hedlund, this is another big problem for the National Republican Party, is it not? These kind of shows the support by someone like Wendy Davis in Texas, which is not exactly a liberal state. They tried as the reason, by the way, she was filibustering is they were trying to outlaw abortions after 20 weeks, and they were trying to make requirements that these clinics become so onerous that the clinics couldn't afford to do business and therefore would shut down.
Well, it plays into this narrative that you hear, you know, hollow candidates like Ed Markey get into when they talk about the war on women. So it feeds into that. Yeah, that's a problem. I applaud the state senator for using parliamentary means that are available to her, the same way I applauded Rand Paul.
He did it on the drones.
On an issue that I'm very excited about, because I filed drone legislation with the ACLU here in Massachusetts that would place limits on the use of drones in Massachusetts. But I wonder, had it not been for the attention that Rand Paul got on utilization of the filibuster, whether she would have. I'm wondering aloud. I'm not criticizing her for it. I just said I applaud her for using it. And Peter makes a great point. She needed a guy to show her.
What a filibuster was. I don't think you meant that, but that's not what I was saying.
He needed a guy to show her.
That's how it can be misread.
You're misreading it then. My point is nobody's really used a filibuster in a long time to the level that Rand Paul took it. And she's done that also. I'm not saying it took a man to do it. The last time I saw a filibuster in my career was a woman, Diane Wilkerson, utilizing it in the Massachusetts State Senate. But
she did?
I don't even remember what it was. I mean, she ended up reading poetry and stuff that wasn't even germane. And then, not to get off subject, but then Senate President Travellini actually allowed a recess, I think, so she or someone else could actually attend a fundraiser that night. And then they came back.
So talk about Massachusetts.
That's not Texas style.
I know. In Texas, you can't have a back brace, but in Massachusetts, we'll take a break so you can go do a fundraiser.
Champagne comes. But the final
point I wanted to make was on Peter's point. Peter makes a great point. And I'll take it a step further, and you're going to all jump on me, but, you know, here we have Ms. Davis being lionized down there, and that's fine. I don't disagree with that. I think it's great that she utilized the means available to her. She's going to lose in the end down there, by the way. But if this had been the example Peter gives, where it was someone defending the Second Amendment and using a filibuster, you would see a lot of pundits on TV destroying that person, calling them a puppet of the NRA, et cetera, et cetera. There'd be a different standard there, I might add.
No, but when you mention Rand Paul and her, I switched on my computer.
So did I.
To watch Rand Paul.
And I was tweeting about it, all excited.
And I'm somewhat ambivalent. I'm not opposed to Rand Paul. He's not my favorite libertarian.
He will be in a couple of years.
But it was exciting, and I was excited to see her. And I think other people, even people who may disagree, to see a politician actually standing up for what they believe in, whether it was the anti-drone policy or whether it was right to life, I mean, politicians today are just so...
Get along, go along.
It feels real.
Well, that's what was wrong with the Senate race, just to back up. They weren't talking about issues. They were extolling talking points. The woman in Texas, Rand Paul in Washington, they stood for something. And that's exciting.
That is the voice of Peter Cassis, who is filling in ably today for the vacationing Jim Browdy. Aaron O'Brien is here from UMass. Bob Hedlund is here from, where do you live, Cohasset?
No, I can't afford Cohasset. I live in Weymouth.
He lives in Weymouth, okay. Is Quincy in your district?
No.
Okay.
No, just north, but I was born there.
I wanted to find out if anyone knew.
My first house there.
So anyone knew about the planes circling around Quincy before you moved on.
Is Bob a man of the people then?
Yes, he's a man of the people. Yeah. Is that correct? You're a man of the people?
I hope so, yeah.
So let's move on to something again that the Republicans are doing. And for women of a certain age, like myself, I find this strategy very annoying. The Republicans painting Clinton as old news for 2016, talking about her being old and stale and over the hill. Now, of course, it is true. She would be 69 by the time the race came through, which is the same time Ronald Reagan was when he was elected. So she would be right in his wheelhouse. But I don't know. Do you want to annoy the older women across America by talking about her as being too old all the time? Remember Rush Limbaugh's famous line that America could not endure watching their president being a female age? We loved him for that.
I'm not going to quote Rush Limbaugh, but I do think for some politicians, time does pass them by. And I think her window has closed significantly. I'd said the same thing as a Republican. I said it about John McCain. You know, I think I probably said it about Bob Dole at one time back in 1988. So, yeah. But if you say it about a woman, you're anti-woman. I mean,
that's right.
There is a reverse double standard there.
I think she's
whatever the quote was. I agree with the quote, but I said the same thing about McCain and I said the same thing about Dole as a Republican. So,
and you're making a policy argument, which I think is very fair. I was in high school when she was around to begin, right? You know, that policy argument, though, unfortunately, isn't what a lot of the higher echelon Republican consultants are making, or the Rush Limbaughs. And that's the problem.
Well, you're going to have some Democrats making it because she'll have competition. And let me ask Aaron,
see, to me, this is a mistake for other reasons. Yes, it's a mistake because of the woman's issue. But look, men under 50 all grew up with working mothers, and a large portion of those men grew up raised by a single working mother. How do you think that demographic, that psychographic, would factor into the election?
I think that's a great point. You've got a mismatch that could be really troublesome for Republicans. If a Republican elite are saying she's too old, and you've got men and women, as Marjorie pointed out, who vote at higher rates, and then men who are raised by single moms or moms and or moms that are working, there's a strategic mismatch between you going after this woman for her age, not her policy. Go after her policy. Right? Go after that. But the age argument turns a lot more people off. It is red meat to the base, but it is politically quite problematic for a general election. But right now, the reason they're doing this now, they won't say this too much in the general election. They won't say this too much in the primary lead up. They're trying to hit her now to get this in our heads.
And I also think, I remember back to the Scott Brown race when my colleague at the Herald, Howie Carr, always called Elizabeth Warren Granny Warren, Granny Ugh. Warren, Granny Warren. You know, you know what? There's a double standard. Because if you ever turn on television at night, Bob Hedlund, I'm sure you may have noticed that the people that are the pundits, the men of the pundits, they're 65, they're fat. They're bald. They've had it.
Hey, wait a minute.
And they're always next to a 25-year-old former federal prosecutor who was a federal prosecutor when she was 12. And that's why there's a double standard, because women are more sensitive about this than men.
Well, MSNBC, all those guys look like they're about 25, those male pundits that they have over there, and they all go to the same optometrist.
But, oh, they do?
They've got the same glasses.
What you're talking about, you know, it's the man and his third wife is what it looks like when you turn on the news.
That's right. That's right.
And so women are, I teach women in politics. I teach women politics and policy. Women are held to a more difficult standard mm-hmm. in terms of being critiqued for their looks. Unfortunately, that remains. But when women run, they are elected at equal rates.
We're talking with Aaron O'Brien from UMass and Bob Hedlund. One last thing, you guys, before we wrap this up. Have you been paying attention to the mayor's race in Boston at all?
A little bit.
Yeah. We have some money figures in the Globe this morning. Who's raised the most money? Dan Conley, John Conley. I forget who's in third place. But what do you see happening there, Aaron O'Brien?
I'm actually doing some policy work for one of the candidates.
Oh, okay.
So I will leave that one alone.
Would that be Charlotte Goloritchie?
It is not.
Okay, Charlotte. The one woman who's running in
I'm doing
this
policy
race.
Consulting work, so
I mean, can,
I,
you, I, can, you, I, can I told, you say?
Yeah, okay. Sure.
Disclosure.
I'm Marty Walsh.
I thought so. I was just guessing. I should have said, I bet it's Marty Walsh.
He's doing pretty well, money-wise, too.
And I know which car in the parking lot is hers, then.
Yes, you do.
Yeah.
But I said, we were talking about the mayoral politics and mayoral, the mayoral race in the green room before we came in, and I said, you know, you mentioned Charlotte Goloritchie.
Yes,
I told
only
Aaron,
girl.
I told Aaron, she's my sleeper candidate, even though she doesn't have a lot of money compared to some of the other candidates. She's my little dark horse candidate. I think she's got a good shot, and she'd make a great mayor.
Well, Charlotte Goloritchie will get a lot of money from Emily's List, I would presume.
Being yes, she's
the
already been backed.
Woman that is running for, and of course, we never had a woman mayor of Boston. We never had an African American as mayor of Boston mm-hmm. either. And there's a lot of African Americans that are running. So
she could very well, at the very least, get into the runoff.
And she's got a lot of networks with Menino and the like. Of course, since we brought it, Marty's really good on labor.
Yes, he's got a lot of union support.
Yeah, a lot of labor
and he's
support.
A state representative. I always get mixed up, state mm-hmm. representative.
State rep.
He's a state representative for a long time from
16 years.
Dorchester.
Yep. Yeah,
okay.
And he finished first in a five or six way state rep special election when Jim Brett left. You know who came in like fifth?
Who?
Martha Coakley.
Martha Coakley.
Yep.
Is that right?
Fourth or fifth, yeah.
When he runs, he wins.
Well, we'll see. So we've got Conley. I think it's Conley, John Conley, who is running very much on a platform to fix the Boston
education.
Boston
Although
schools.
He runs, there are more issues there, but that's what he's best yep. known for.
We had
Sorry,
a lot of
these
folks okay. in at UMass, and we've got a plethora of good candidates, which is a
yes.
really nice thing for
yeah.
Boston.
Yeah.
I mean, they came and talked to students when they can't fundraise, which is amazing, right? And a lot of the students got internships with them, and they're excited about it. Young people in Boston are pumped because, when I do the introductions and for these candidates, would say, you have no conscious memory of a Boston
yes.
without Menino. So young people are involved, and it's an exciting time to be in Boston and Massachusetts politics.
One last point, if I may, on that. It would have been a more exciting race, or it would have certainly added a little something to the race if there was maybe a high-profile person with some private sector experience. It's the one thing all the candidates have is they're all creatures of...
Bill Walczak.
Of government.
He's got some good private sector.
Yeah, well,
that's a nonprofit,
yeah,
though, right?
I'm talking, and he's the richest guy in the race, ironically. The guy coming from the nonprofit.
Yeah.
If you look at his financial SFIs, he's the
UMass Boston
the wealthiest guy in the race coming from the nonprofit.
The key is to run the nonprofit, not to work for one. That seems
right.
to be
I mean,
Or if you're on the board of one.
That's
right. If Walczak had made his money on State Street, no one would be begrudging him the money.
That's a good point.
Unless, but if you're a Republican and you're successful, they go after you and attack you and use your business record as a negative, like they did in the Gomez race.
Okay. Well, you run on it. You're running on your record, so they're going to go after your record.
We have been talking, and that's all we're going to talk about this, with Erin O'Brien, Associate Professor of Political Science at UMass Boston. Erin, thank you very much for being with us today. And Senator Bob Hedlund, State Senator from Weymouth, who did not compete in the triathlon. But we won't hold against you.
He didn't want to show them up.
That's right. Thank you very much, both of you guys, for coming in today, Erin and Bob Hedlund. Okay, coming up, speaking of big salaries, we're not talking nonprofit salaries. We are talking CEO salaries. Did you know the average CEO makes 273 times? That's 273 times what the average worker makes. Does this drive you crazy? It drives me crazy. We'll dig into that disparity next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Not too long ago, a tornado devastated Moore, Oklahoma, as the community rebuilds for one business owner.
Work-wise, I may be completely out of luck in being able to reopen my office.
I'm David Gura. We go back to Moore 1 month after the storm, next time on Marketplace from APM.
Tonight at 6 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you. And Citizens Bank, presenting sponsor of the 2013 Boston Globe WGBH Summer Arts Weekend, July 26th, 27th, and 28th in Boston's Copley Square. You can learn more at bostonsummerarts.com. And Stonebridge at Burlington, who believe assisted living should provide choices such as art classes, a full-service spa, and a cafe. If you agree seniors deserve to live well and love life, you can find Stonebridge at nextgenerationseniors.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy is on vacation this week. I am Marjorie Egan. WGBH's Peter Kazis, former editor of the great late Boston Phoenix that we all miss terribly, is filling in for Jim Browdy today. So this just drives me nuts because I'm so insanely jealous. It drives Peter Kazis a little bit nuts. But let me give you the basic facts in, and you can weigh in at 877-301-8970. Here's the deal. This new study by the Economic Policy Institute, this nonpartisan think tank, says CEO salaries are rising faster, and they're rising faster by the millions than the salaries of those people who work for them. Now the average salary of a CEO is 273 times the average worker's, the average person that works in that company. And listen to this. This is the one that really drives me nuts, because to me this explains why we're in the economic mess we're in. Between 1978 and 2012, CEO salaries soared by 875%, while the typical worker's pay went up just 5.4%. So what do you think about this at 877-301-8970? If it bothers you, what do we do about it? Do we just complain about it? Do we need some kind of government regulation? I mean, can you imagine the government trying to regulate these salaries? People go nuts. Should we just shame these CEOs until they give up? What do you think? 877-301-8970. Peter Kazis, what do you think?
Well, what I think is I'm amazed that shareholders let companies get away with this. But it underscores, you know, I was going to say a paradox, just how blatantly broken our system is. You know, conservatives will be talking about, well, it's a free system and everything regulates itself, and you know, there may be little bumps in the road and minor pieces of inequity, but in the end it all comes out right. In the end, it doesn't come out right. You know, I suppose there's some good news in that the salaries as a percentage aren't as high as they used to be. But do you know?
I guess the peak was 2000. Is that it's come down somewhat since 2000?
2000 was the peak, but from 1978 to 2012, CEO salaries increased by 875%. I mean, it's obscene. There's no other word for it.
And the other part is that drives me nuts is that meanwhile, regular people's salaries have gone up 5.4%. You know, I used to waitress a million years ago in the late 70s, and I made as much money. Now, part of that is because the taxes have changed. You have to give more in your taxes from tips. But I used to make as much waitressing then as my kids made like 4 and 5 years ago, because it's just crazy how the lower wage or the minimum wage or the blue-collar wage has not kept pace. Our numbers are 877-301-8970. It's like the haves are over here getting heavier and the nots are down there getting naughtier. It's just the spread is getting worse and worse and worse. And the middle class, I mean, look at what happened. You know, they're not going to take care of these student loan things, which is another subject, but it's just indicative of how the middle class keeps getting screwed. Remember how, I mean, when you and I were growing up, Peter, you know, fathers could support. You had 6 kids in your family.
My dad worked in the factory before he became a teacher. But my dad was a factory worker, then a teacher, and he supported 6 kids.
Supported 6 kids. And your mother was not working 2 jobs, I assume. She was bringing up the 6
kids,
correct?
She was bringing up the 6 kids.
I mean, who can raise 6 children in a reasonably comfortable manner so you can... Excuse me, maybe take a vacation to the beach for a week or something like that in the summer and put something away toward college. It's like impossible. So it's absolutely driving me crazy. And the question is, what do we do? Do we just do nothing and complain, or do we shame? I think we should shame people, myself.
Well, if less people think that we're raging socialists over here.
Well, sometimes I am a raging socialist on this stuff.
The thing is, this year's CEO increase is twice what the stock market increased.
Great point.
It's twice what the stock market increased. You know, if it were pegged to something like stock performance, you might say, well, okay, I understand. There's a rule. But yikes.
I know. 877-301-8970. Before I get to the calls, I remember there was a great piece about 6 months ago in the Wall Street Journal, and it talked about a guy who ran a car company, and forgive me, I should have brought it with me, but I forgot until just this second, back in the 70s in Detroit. And, of course, he had a beautiful home. I don't know if it was in Detroit or in the suburbs, and he had 4 or 5 children, and his wife was a stay-at-home mom, and they had a very nice lifestyle. But the point was his salary was 70 times what the average worker was. Now it's 273 times. And when it was the peak in 2000, it was 383 times. It's just outrageous. And we laud these people. We don't say, I mean, we'll get calls today saying, you know, whatever the market will bear, this is a capitalist country. That's absolutely fine. But there's something really kind of creepy about it. Listen to some of these salaries. This guy, Philip Dahlman, who's the chief executive of Viacom, $84.5 million a year. Now, I don't know, Peter. I don't mind you getting maybe 10 million, maybe 15, maybe 20. The woman Melissa Meyer from Yahoo, I think she's up 36 or something like that million dollars, which is too high. But you know, when you get above 20 million a year, what the hell are you going to do with all this money?
Well, see, what's interesting is it's not just the CEOs. In some of the technology companies, there are other people who make even more than the CEOs do. That might be able to be justified because they are technological innovators. But if you look at, you can't just look at it in isolation. You have to put it in terms of this larger trend. And it shows how all the money is flowing over to, you know, one side of the ledger. And it has economic consequences. One reason our economy is so weak is because there's been, stagnant wage growth.
Exactly. Exactly. People are making the same amount of money now they did like 30 years ago.
Or less.
Or less. Now, to get us in the mood for this before we get to the phone call, 877-301-8970, is a little line from the classic Wall Street movie. Of course, it was named Wall Street. Here's the voice of Michael Douglas from that 1987 movie, Wall Street.
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works.
Well, it worked then, and it's working today.
Okay. Our numbers are 877-301-8970. What do you think? You may think this is fine. This is what the market will bear. These are private companies. What the heck do we care? You may think this is outrageous. And if you do think it's outrageous, what do we do about it? Let's go to John on the road. Hi, John. Thanks for calling Boston Public Radio.
Thanks for taking my call, Marjorie.
Sure.
Hey, I just wanted to put this out there that, you know, we're talking about for-profits right now.
Right.
But it would be very interesting to check out the Commonwealth's non-for-profits and the salary scheme for CEOs of those groups.
Well, that's a great point. Remember, the classic story in Boston was when Cleves Killingsworth was making $11 million as the head of Blue Cross, when Blue Cross was losing money left and right and took off with that wonderful golden parachute. And Blue Cross is a nonprofit. I think the salaries are a lot less impressive at Harvard Pilgrim and Fallon Healthcare and all that kind of stuff. But what do you think, John? We should be, and of course, we talk about the guy that runs NSTAR, Tom May. He was the $9 million man. Now he's the $90 million man.
Right.
So what do we do, John? What do we do about them?
I think we hold, if a nonprofit is overcompensating their leadership, mm-hmm. I think the community should really hold them to task and ask them to explain why. You know, we have this altruistic bent towards folks who do run nonprofits, and I'm speaking as a former CEO of a national nonprofit in the HIV/AIDS arena. And I was making 120, and I thought that was outrageous. And again, they're board-appointed salaries, but still, there has to be some kind of accountability.
John, thank you for the call. That's a great point. Now, Christopher just emailed, and by the way, the email is bpr@wgbh.org, and says, you know, points out the sports analogy, which Aaron Hernandez was making $40 million working for the New England Patriots, and that's an astronomical amount of money, too.
It that may be, but he's not a CEO, and look at all the joy, you know, before this these horrible accusations of murder. He's a performer. He's a movie star. You can quantify what he does. By the way, I think those figures are cuckoo, but nevertheless, it's not the same as a CEO, and it's a closed shop. You know, you've got other CEOs voting on the compensation. You know, it's like CEOs have their own union. It's a union of pirates.
Well, that's one of the things that when they had the big Blue Cross scandal here in Boston, you found out that the person that was on the board, you know, everybody was scratching each other's back. If you work for Blue Cross, you're on the board of the other healthcare agencies or other big deal companies in town, and everybody was taking care of everybody else. 877-301-8970. Are you outraged, to use a tabloid kind of word that Peter Kazis used, and chastise me for using the word outrage, Peter?
I'm saving that for later, for another segment.
Okay. Are you outraged, or maybe you're just mildly distressed, that salaries for CEOs are 273 times the line workers? What do you think about that? Let's go to Colleen from Melrose. What do you think, Colleen?
Yeah, so I've been listening to you, and the consumer has a lot more power than we think we do. I mean, we're the ones that actually feed the money to these CEOs. And if you do your research and you find out about companies and you're aggravated and annoyed about, you know, whether a CEO makes too much money or Walmart makes clothes in Bangladesh, we have the power to say, well, I'm not going to use this company anymore. I'm not going to spend my money that's going to go towards this company. So I think, yes, I am outraged, but I do feel like as a consumer that I do have some power to say, you know, not on my dime.
Yeah. Well, that's a great point, Colleen. Thank you for the call. But, you know, it becomes difficult to say. Look at Leslie Moonves. He runs CBS. He just got a 32% raise. Now he's up to $56.9 million. I don't know. I occasionally do like to tune into certain shows on CBS. I don't know if I could. My principals could compel me to give up CBS in protest of his salary.
No, I have to say, I'm surprised that there are not more organized consumer boycotts for not just CEO pay, for a whole variety of things. It's a very, very difficult subject. I'll tell you, the publication that is most eloquent in its outrage on the subject is, of all places, Forbes magazine.
Really? Forbes, a business magazine?
Yes, the capitalist tool, because Forbes's point of view is they're not on management side. They're on the stockholder side. And the Forbes writing on this subject tends to say that they think this is a ripoff of the stockholders. They'd say, why not, you know, pay him a big salary, but not this big, and I'm oversimplifying, but have that money go back in dividends to the shareholders. They see it as a corporate ripoff of shareholders.
Well, you know what I don't understand? I guess I don't understand why more of these people aren't a little embarrassed about this, because it's obviously, when you're talking about making $100 million a year or $85 million a year, or, you know, some of these salaries, maybe you could say that this guy's okay. The guy that runs Target, for example, he had made $23 million. I don't know, maybe that's okay. It's not up to the 80, you know, 50 and above kind of deal. But why you don't feel sort of that this is embarrassing? It's an embarrassment of riches, to use an overtrite phrase. Didn't we used to feel that way?
Well, see, I think, Margie, it's not that you should be embarrassed about how much you make. It's how much it's the context. How much do you make in relationship to the lowest paid employee? You know, that's what the outrage here is, that these CEOs, men and women, have been driving down, pushing down with their thumbs the salaries of the working class.
That's right. We should repeat this. At the same time that CEO salaries have gone up by 875%, which is between from the 70s to 2012, the average worker's increase in pay has been an average of 5.4%, which explains a lot of the increasing disparity in America and around the world, really, between the have and the have-nots.
And not only have salaries for working people gone down, the nature of the jobs have changed. They've become more part-time as well as lower paid. I mean, it is impossible, or it's not impossible, it's extremely difficult for working men and women to get by today, and that ripples through the economy. One reason the economy is going to have a less than 2% growth this year is no one has enough money to buy things. And in a consumer society, that's a little cuckoo.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Our numbers are 877-301-8970. Let's go to Aaron from Marlboro. What do you think, Aaron?
Hi, so I agree with there's a thing in Switzerland where most of the companies only make about 30, like the CEOs only make about 33 times the amount of their lowest paid workers.
Really?
I think we should have something along that lines, just so there's not this 250 plus times the lowest paid worker. I mean, it's just fair. And also, I think a big thing about the American capitalist society is that we view money as an infinite resource when it's really a cycle and a finite resource.
So
if one person takes it all, then what's left for everybody else?
Aaron, does the government enforce this 33% rule?
I mean, I guess I would have to, but it probably won't pass because, I mean, all the money from corporations fund all the campaigns.
But in Switzerland, the government enforces it.
Yeah, okay. That would be the only way to do it. I mean, consumers won't be able to enforce that.
Aaron, thank you for the call. Can you imagine for one single solitary second anybody even entertaining a passage of legislation like that in the United States of America? It would never happen.
I'll tell you, in Japan, there's not legislation, but by custom, I'm not sure of the number, but by custom, Japanese CEOs and executives in general only make, you know, X percent. I don't know off the top of my head what it is, because it's just considered sort of impolite to make too much more than your lowest person. And by the way, they're still well compensated.
Well, I guess that's what I'm getting at. That this seems to be almost like a crusade. Like drunk driving is not a great analogy, but you know, 40, 50 years ago, drunk driving was kind of a joke. People would make jokes about how they barely get home last night because they were out cavorting. Now it's a very serious matter. Mothers Against Drunk Driving changed the whole attitude about getting behind the wheel when you've been drinking. It seems to me we need sort of effort. I don't know how you do it, but this is not something to be lauded. It's something to be ashamed of because you're greedy.
Pension funds and 401k funds. You know, I think what we really need is shareholder activists. Most people out there listening may say, well, I'm not really a stockholder. Well, if you have a 401k, you are a stockholder, most likely. I mean, you're putting your retirement money into Wall Street. And the lack of democracy in our financial system just astounds me.
But you can't go talk if you're a shareholder at Target or Exxon or something.
You
can't get up and give a speech. You have to hold a certain amount of stock, right?
But it is possible to pressure mutual funds and all. Look at the college students. Back in the old days, when they organized boycotts of South Africa and companies that did business with South Africa, it is possible to do. I mean, frankly, Occupy Wall Street, which has fallen off the map.
I know.
I always had mixed feelings about Occupy, but I wish they had put their minds to doing something useful, such as this.
877-301-8970, bpr@wgbh.org is our email address. Jim Browdy's on vacation this week. Peter Kaz is from WGBH-TV, actually radio. Are you on TV too? He's a versatile guy. He does a little TV, does a little radio, does a little writing. Peter Kazis, in any case, is filling in for Jim Browdy. Chris from Cambridge, what do you think about this disparity between the CEOs and the regular line worker?
Thanks for taking my call. My thought is really, until we have campaign finance reform, none of this will ever change, because these CEOs fund all our politicians.
That's right.
Our politicians become millionaires, and it's a cycle. Then our politicians, after they retire, become CEOs. And so it's a cycle of the elite, and it's horrible. But I don't think anything will change until we have a movement where we have real politicians who are not millionaires who can win and fight for things like the minimum wage,
okay,
for Meals on Wheels.
Okay. Now, Chris, let me ask you this, because mm-hmm. I know lots of people hate this idea, but mm-hmm. I am a big proponent of term limits. And the reason is, I think the only way you're going to get people to do what they should do as opposed to what they need to do to get reelected and get their campaign coffers stuffed with tens of thousands of dollars is if there's term limits and they don't have to worry constantly about the next election. I bet you're opposed to term limits, though.
No, I'm not opposed to term limits.
Oh, good.
But I also think that all elections should be federally funded. I don't think there should be any private money going into it. It's just people talk about the Citizens United. It was corrupt before Citizens United came along. You know, Obama, who, you know, I like him a lot, but he, you know, was going to take federal money until, he realized he could raise billions. So why not? I mean, it's a totally corrupt system. It's not a democracy. We live in a money system.
A plutocracy.
A plutocracy.
Well,
Chris, thank you for
the
call.
Okay.
Is that what it's called, a plutocracy?
A plutocracy.
Thank
ruled
you
by
very
the rich.
Much, Peter Kaz. That's right. We are ruled by the rich, and I've had it. I don't know what I'm going to do about it, but it just does drive me crazy. I mean, what do you really do after the first $10 million? You know, how many boats can you buy? I'm just not clear. And even if you have like 12 kids, I mean, you've got enough money to give each of them like this huge pot of money.
Well, you have to ask yourself, what has changed over the last 20 years? We had this great financial calamity. You know, we had Wall Street collapse. Where is the hue and cry? Where are the people, you know, waving their pitchforks?
Well, we're hewing and crying right here.
Well, we're trying. We are hewing and crying. But I'm just saying, you see how little things have changed.
Yeah. Okay. Jillian from Chelmsford. What do you think, Jillian?
Well, I just have to say, first of all, I totally agree with the last person that I don't think it's going to change until there's real reform of the political system, because it is a vicious cycle. But to me, I think what makes the most sense is it's not in the best interest of the government, because it hurts our economy, for there to be this huge discrepancy.
Right.
What would make sense, if they weren't all in the pockets of the rich, is to have a system where actually you pay taxes based on discrepancy, because that would give an incentive to not. It's not in the government's interest, so why do they support it? So in a sense, if there's the discrepancy is 33, you pay a much lower tax rate. And if the discrepancy is 273, you pay through the roof. Because in the long run, the government's going to have to pick up for things like health care for Walmart workers, because they pick up for the poor. So in a sense, it's only fair that if you're not paying your workers, then the government is going to take a bigger portion. And that would actually incentivize the shareholders, because they're not going to want to pay higher taxes.
Well, that's certainly...
Jillian, that's a great call.
That's certainly a different way of looking at it. And it's the first original thing I've heard on this subject for a long time.
Yeah, that's very clever. I have an email from Anne, who's talking about... this is what Anne says. We are all in our late 40s, early 50s. Most of our parents who are retired now worked for companies with unions, so they had pensions, medical benefits. When they worked, they work 40 hours, home by 5 p.m., and didn't travel. Now we work unbelievably long hours, spend time traveling for meetings and conferences, and really work only 40 hours a week. Don't need separate unions, but need strong enforced work guidelines. If this happens, money would be pulled from the CEOs, she hopes, to pay workers what they really deserve, so they can actually live on a 40-hour a week schedule. Do you know anybody that works 40 hours a week? Very few people.
No, most people work. Most people who are lucky enough to be working are working longer hours. You know who this would be a good issue for? Elizabeth Warren.
It would be a great issue for her. Well, she just, her initiative, although it was like a drop in the bucket to lower student interest rates, which were now 3-something, she wanted to get them down to 0.75, the rates that banks in certain situations can borrow at. That was supposed to happen by July 1st. Of course, it hasn't happened. So now people, kids who have enormous student loans, now they're seeing their interest rates go from 3-something to 6-something. I mean, that's basically a double. My daughter's ready to, you know, jump out the window over this, because she's got massive student loans. I mean, it's just terrible. Nothing happened. Nothing happened.
He has another outrage.
Outrage, you said it.
I said it. Here's another outrage that's on the other end of the pay scale, that increasing numbers of people who are paid hourly, like people who make $7.45 an hour or $8, they get their pay on a card that's like an ATM card, rather than getting a check, or rather than getting direct deposit. And every time they use their card, in other words, every time they want to withdraw money they've made, they're charged by the bank.
Really?
Yes. This is a new development. J.P. Morgan Chase is one of the people who is doing this. So that, like a cleaning lady, she doesn't get a check. She doesn't get direct deposit. She gets her card credited. And every time she goes to take her literally hard-earned money out, the bank takes a slice
of
it.
Yeah, those are the banks that were too big to fail and now are even bigger than they were when they were too big to fail in 2008. Let's squeeze in one more call before we move on. Teresa from Norwell, what do you think about the CEOs making salaries going up at 875%? That's right, compared to the average Joe, 5.4%.
That's over a 20-year period.
Yes, it wasn't just last year. I should clarify that. Yeah. What do you think, Teresa?
I just think it's ridiculous, and I think a lot of people are extremely upset about it, but don't know if anything can be done. I think that a lot of the CEOs are tyrants that have egos to match and actually think they're worth that kind of money. I know I worked in corporate America, and, you know, the more they reduced expenses by getting rid of people, the more the stockholders rewarded them for increasing the stock price. So, you know, and then when they had the banking crisis, they, AIG and the rest of them kept saying,
well, if we don't pay our CEOs these exorbitant salaries, we won't get the best talent or the talent that we need. And, you know, I'd like to see a company test that theory and actually hire someone at a normal salary, not 275 times what everyone else is making, and see if the companies can't be run by an intelligent person who actually has some morals. Maybe there should be more women in the CEO force.
I'm with you, Teresa. Thank you very much for the call. Okay, we got to move on because up next we have an open mic, as we do every Monday at 1 o'clock, with Reverend Eugene Rivers III. He's going to be with us next talking about a new movie, talking about an initiative to deal with the violence and the shootings in the city of Boston. Stay tuned for that conversation. Gene Rivers is up next on Boston Public Radio 89.7.
An intriguing historic treasure of original photos and scrapbooks and clothing from a World War II concentration camp recently serviced in an unlikely place, Wayland High School.
The idea that there were all these documents that have been sitting in a high school, basically unknown for so many decades, was unbelievable.
I'm WGBH reporter Kirk Carapeza. Historic Holocaust artifacts at Wayland High, this afternoon on WGBH's All Things Considered.
We love our contributors. That means you and the Museum of Science, where you can uncover a portal to ancient times at the new Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit. See what life was really like over 2,000 years ago. More information at mos.org. And Boston Private Bank, helping business owners, entrepreneurs, nonprofits, and families manage their banking and investment needs. This is your time. This is your private bank. Boston Private Bank. BostonPrivateBank.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brady is on vacation. Peter Kaz is from WGBH is filling in. I am Marjorie Egan, and we are welcoming the Reverend Eugene Rivers, as we do every Monday at 1 o'clock. But before we get to any of the issues we want to talk about, I opened up the Boston Globe yesterday, Metro section, turned the paper, and I see Sojourner Rivers, the famous Sojourner I think I've heard about here. Your kid was in the Globe yesterday. Why did you have a picture in the Globe?
Sojourner Alice Rivers was in the Globe because Mayor Menino, to his credit, had all of his staff out reaching out in Warren Gardens to enlist young people to get in summer programs and to get jobs. Listen, Mayor Menino, Don Menino, sir, I want to commend you. And if any of your people are listening, I want the record to show. Dot Joyce, Mr. Knievy, we salute the mayor for putting his troops out there. So Sojourner was out there in that heat, going door to door, doing. She's a real organizer.
Good for her.
And she's got the brains of her mother and the looks, right? Which it was, God was merciful.
Yeah,
right?
She went to Harvard.
Yeah. Yes, she did.
La-di-da.
She was out working. She's amazing. Sojourner, I love you. You're the best.
Okay. So Reverend Rivers, I want to know, there's been a lot of talk, you know, about the multiple shootings. I think we're up to 70-some since the marathon in Boston, the millions and millions raised by the One Fund, and the, you know, the recent frenzy, media frenzy over Aaron Hernandez. Joan Vernacki had a great line here, and she had it on television. She said, now we know what it takes to get attention for a black man shot in Dorchester. Make sure he's shot by a New England Patriot.
Joan Vernacki's the best.
But I understand that there is some action. Now, I know Reverend Bruce Wall was looking for a state of emergency, one of the mayoral candidates to address this. There's something happening vis-a-vis violence in the city that you can tell us about.
I had a conversation with State Representative Carlos Enriquez.
That's right.
And he is organizing a press conference to get the elected officials of color more involved. I received word of that on Saturday. I called him late last night And I said, State Representative Enriquez, I want to commend you for convening this press conference because, at the very least, you're sending a message that the black elected officials care. Now, beyond press conferences, we need models and strategies and resources to really dig in. But I wanted, and I told State Representative Enriquez, now, State Representative, I'm going to applaud you, brother. Now, if in 2 weeks you ain't done nothing more than that, we're going to have a problem. Because I'm going to come out and I'm going to talk about you again. So, brother, I salute you. But the black elected officials, Ayanna Pressley, Tito Jackson, these individuals who have done great work need to do more. Because I'm going to raise this question with y'all and to the public. How many black innocent children would need to die before someone would think that the financial resources which were raised for the humans would apply to the black people? And
Gene Rivers?
That were raised for, would you repeat that?
That were raised for the humans.
Human, so you're suggesting that people of color...
Human life is valuable.
Okay.
Okay. You're suggesting a disparity between the black kids
I'm
in the city of
question.
Boston.
Okay. I'm a black guy. I can't be that smart, right?
Come on. We're doing the old Socratic thing. Listen, let me point something out. 20 years ago, when Chris Lydon, who's also occupies
every Thursday at 1 o'clock.
20 years ago, when Chris Lydon made his quixotic but very smart run for mayor, he said of violence at that time that if this level of violence were taking place in West Roxbury, that there would be national.
Which is a predominantly Irish neighborhood. Is it still mostly Irish? Yeah, I think so.
That the National Guard would be stationed on every street corner. Now, that was 20 years ago. That was 20 years ago.
In Watertown, it was virtual martial law.
But
they shut that place down.
They did.
God bless them.
But the situation is not really analogous.
Okay.
What would happen? Are we to shut down? I'm playing devil's advocate.
Let's do it. Let's get it.
Are we to
in.
Shut down all of Boston? Are we to shut down those
neighborhoods? Well, did they shut down all of Boston? Wait. Excuse me. If memory serves, they essentially shut down all of Boston.
They did. After the marathon.
Well, it was still voluntary.
I think in Hyde Park kind of run around. Well, it was voluntary.
It was
voluntary.
But
what are you talking about? I mean, when you talk about, I mean, Bruce Wall is talking about a state of emergency. Are you talking about a state of emergency? Are you talking about something different? What are you talking about?
What I'm saying is this, and I'll reframe the question. How many young black people need to die, right, innocent young people need to die before the same level of urgency which was communicated by the leadership of this state in terms of resources? That's my question. And
so we're talking about DeVal Patrick does not think this is urgent enough. Is that what you're
saying?
That's not what I said. But that's what you're suggesting.
No, I'm raising the question to the public because you know what's powerful about this? We're the most liberal town in the most liberal state.
Right.
Now, how many young black people need to suffer terrorism, right, and die before there's a comparable level of concern like that exhibited for the humans that died on Boylston Street or were injured?
Okay.
I was sitting there. Listen, I saw the paper on Saturday, right? $8,000 a pop if you were injured in some way. Okay. I said, okay. Now, if I get a nick, can I get $8,000? If I'm living and I'm being subjected to terrorism, say if I, you know, let me go slap myself or nick myself and I get $8,000. And listen, and I'm not begrudging the recipients.
But what should happen, though? I guess because we've been talking about
this for
the last couple of weeks.
Yes.
And some people will tell you, well, there's a lot of good programs, but there's not enough summer jobs, or there's not enough good programs. We need more programs. Or the schools are terrible, and that's the problem. We can't get anywhere. I mean, what do we do? I mean, I think there's a lot of people who do feel bad. They don't know what to do.
See, my concern is this. I'm not even saying that someone should do thoughtlessly, just run out and hug a black kid in the hood. I'm not saying anything stupid like that. I'm saying what would be the necessary and sufficient conditions to have an adult conversation. Now, mind you, for me, and I want for the record, my issue has been black leadership has failed to do their job sufficiently. I don't blame white people because when those folk, the vast majority of whom were white, said, "Not no, hell no. You are not going to bring that craziness to Boylston Street. They were legitimate. That was correct. That was a rational response to a violation. The black community has not maintained a comparable level of vigilance. And I'm not criticizing white people for that, because that's our problem. Now, my question is, what needs to happen? How bad do things need to be before there is a much more intensive and transparent engagement of the issue? So I'm not even asking for somebody to write me a check. How do we begin to have a more adult conversation? That's all I'm asking for. Because obviously something is not working if there are all of these deployment strategies and programs and we got all this hell flying in this hood. Somebody's strategy is not working.
Well, could one of the questions we ask be, how do you convict the shooters?
Yes. And you know what? I just learned something that I want to share because I think it's important to observe. You know what? There was 1,000% cooperation on the part of the public at the marathon.
Right.
In the black community, it's pulling teeth because in one shooting incident, there must have been 20 or 30 people there. No one called up to give any information to the police. Now, I can't blame the white folk for that. Black people, somebody got killed. There are 22 witnesses. You don't step up. You've got an excuse about how you don't like the cops. Then you complain because the clearance rates are bad in the black community and they're different in the white community. So I own, for the record, that the black community has to be more vigilant and cooperate. You don't have people shoot up your neighborhood, then you don't cooperate with the police, then you complain about the police. That's irrational.
Yeah, except that one reason you might not want to cooperate with the police is you're worried about the person that shot somebody up two blocks from down the
street
from you.
That's absolutely true. That's an excellent point.
Yeah, I would be pretty scared.
No. And in fact, that's an excellent point. I had Captain Sexton from C-11 make this observation last week. It was actually a brilliant observation. He said, listen, there's a difference between cooperating when nobody's going to come shoot you.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And living in the hood. And if you show up in court, the dude says, gives you the look.
And that has happened.
And that has happened frequently. Yeah. So there is that difficulty. But therefore, I'm saying, how much worse do things need to be before there is?
Well, what's the answer?
Listen, I don't have the power. I can't say. It's pretty bad now.
Yeah, it's pretty bad now. The threshold with the women in the cars and the babies in the back seat.
We're hitting that threshold now.
Yes.
I mean, because it's jumping from the inside of the newspaper and from the front page of smaller community papers onto airwaves such as these.
Yes.
So I would say we're at that threshold. The only good thing about this is there's a mayor's race going on.
In fact, I am asking, and I had this conversation with Jim and Marjorie, please partner with someone in the print media. The Boston Herald sounds like a good place.
Oh, yeah, we're going to have our violence summit.
Yeah, no, please. I'm asking for the record.
Yeah.
Mr. Shaka, my good friend.
Joe Shaka, editor of the Boston Herald.
Right. Please, I understand the Globe's going to do their thing. Could the Boston Herald with WGBH convene an adult conversation?
That's a great idea.
Where we ask the adult questions to every one of the mayoral candidates. We applaud the mayor for the brilliant 20 years that of work he's done. And then every one of those individuals has to commit to outlining their plan for how they're going to address the issue of violence in our poorest neighborhoods.
We're going to take a very quick call, and then we're going to move on to this movie, because I want to talk about this movie, this Fruitvale Station, which has got rave reviews at the Sundance Film Festival. But very quickly, Tommy from Alabama, Montgomery, Alabama, you're on the phone. What do you want to say to Reverend Rivers?
Yes. I want to answer that question. Until we in the black community start telling who's committing these crimes, we know where the dope houses are. We know where the gangbangers are.
Say it, brother.
But we don't want to say anything about it. Then when the police don't arrest nobody, we want to go down there and talk about them and throw about putting more money in the community. Don't put nothing in the community until people step up to the plate and start protecting their children.
Say it, black man.
But we just had this conversation, though, Tommy. I mean, it's a lot to ask someone to go testify as a witness in a murder trial when you live three blocks from the shooter's house. I mean, and you're a 19-year-old girl or a 19-year-old boy. You know what I mean?
I understand that. But when we was marching in Alabama for the right to vote, people died. for that right. We are going to have to start putting ourselves on the line once again to raise our children. I have a 7-month-old grandbaby and a 13-year-old grandson. And their life expectancy is, what, 19, 18 years old? But here I am, the granddaddy, and I won't stand, I don't believe in the system enough that if I know someone doing something against my child, that I won't go talk.
Say it, black man.
Tommy, thank you for the call. You are a very brave man. Personally, I'm a big chicken. I wouldn't have been marching anywhere, anytime,
a week after the downtown, the Copley Square bombings, I went to one of the regular meetings that
Gene Rivers.
Sorry. Reverend Rivers runs. And it was very interesting, the number of people who just routinely were saying that, look, I don't let my kids walk to the T-stop if I don't walk with them. We don't send the kids out to buy milk after dark.
Awful.
I mean, and by the way, these were guys dressed in business suits. I don't know what they did for a living, but, you know, these were clearly professional, and they all happened to be men. And I live in Jamaica Plain, and I know at night when my kids are coming home, we meet them at the T-stop. And my neighborhood's only like a little bit dangerous. It's not like it's a really dangerous neighborhood.
You know what's going to be the recreational distraction, diversion over the next 5 days?
What?
Young black people laying in their beds, distinguishing between gunshots and firecrackers.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, God. No.
Every year in certain neighborhoods.
They'll know the difference.
They will know the difference. Okay. How crazy is it that a 4 or 5 or 6-year-old child has as his recreational diversion, as he lays in his bed 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night, as he distinguishes and debates with his brother in the bed across the room, what's a firecracker and a gunshot? And those are the conditions under which these young black people live. And I'm saying, how much more of that before? What's the man that put together the One Boston Fund?
Oh, Kenneth Feinberg.
I would like to ask Kenneth Feinberg. Mr. Feinberg, what would be the necessary and sufficient conditions under which there would be a comparable level of concern for the black young people who live with the terror that says for the next 3 or 4 days, we're going to spend our time thinking about, you know, distinguishing between firecrackers and gunshots. In fact, you know, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. My wife and I, for the last 20 years, you know what we do? We go to the fireworks on downtown.
Yep.
Right.
Just to get out the hood.
Yep.
Because there's so much madness.
Okay. Before we go, I want to talk about this movie because I did see the trailer, and we all remember.
I saw it last week.
Yeah. Okay. It's called Fruitvale Station. It is the true story of 22-year-old Oscar Grant, who was shot by the cops back in 2009. Got all sorts of accolades at the Sundance
Film
Festival.
Amazing. Great review yesterday in the Times.
So tell us about this movie, Fruitvale Station.
It's literally the last day in the life of the young man who was murdered by the Bay Area
Transit,
and
MBTA Transit Authority.
Right.
Yep.
It is the most amazing film because what they do is they don't paint the child, the young man, as a saint. So it's not some simplistic. It's a very powerful, just an enormously powerful, artistically powerful treatment of how that boy woke up in the morning and how he died that night. It's just an enormously... And what's interesting, I went to a screening last week with my wife, and the producer, the director of the film, in the conversation, he did a powerful riff on black people. 93% of the black males that get killed by black people. So while I'm opposed to what happened at BART, it was terrible, the vast majority of what happens in the black community is self-inflicted. And not about white people, but it's an enormous, artistically, it's absolutely brilliant film.
Well, this is another one of those stories that is made possible by the video revolution.
Yeah.
There are untold numbers of of people with their cell cameras who caught what in effect is the execution of this young man.
Yeah.
And these videos, at first I thought I was watching the movie. Then I realized, no, I'm watching a citizen captured video.
In real time.
In real time. And the officer later said, oh, I thought I was going to tase him, and I shot him by mistake.
Oh, God.
Now, and I'm watching this. You hear it often. And I'm thinking, my word, how can you make that mistake?
It's amazing.
And the kid, I can honestly say, this isn't like Rodney King,
right,
where, you know, there was a crack fuel chase and there was all this. This isn't like, this is a young man sitting down. With his two buddies and...
Sitting down.
It was really depressing.
No, the portrayal of the young man laying on his stomach, handcuffed, and they murder him, handcuffed, face down. Shot him in the...
Okay, for an uplifting July 4th fun movie, go see.
It's a brilliant film.
Fruitvale Station. It has gotten rave reviews, and I read about it. I will go see it. It's a very sad tale. This 22-year-old young man. That was the voice of the Reverend Eugene Rivers. This is the voice of the Reverend Eugene Rivers. Always energetic. He's with us every Monday at 1 o'clock.
Happy 4th of July, y'all.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Gene Rivers, for being with us as always. And tune in again a week from today to hear him again. Coming up, Steve Morantz joins us to talk about his new book about life and baseball. Up next at Fenway, you're listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH.
Hey, it's Jim Browdy.
And I'm Marjorie Egan.
And we'd like to thank everyone who supported Boston Public Radio during the June community campaign.
Actually, Jim wanted to thank every one of you personally, but we only have 30 seconds.
Your support means this station will continue to keep this whole community connected to news and information.
And thanks to you, this station will be fundraiser-free for the rest of the summer.
You can still do your part online at WGBHnews.org.
And many thanks.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Stonebridge at Burlington, who believe assisted living should provide choices such as art classes, a full-service spa, and a cafe. If you agree seniors deserve to live well and love life, you can find Stonebridge at nextgenerationseniors.com. An In-You Window in Natick with the Hunter Douglas Lighter Side of Living event, featuring cordless light-rise blackout duet Arcatella, as well as motorized shades controlled from your smartphone. InYouWindow.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy is on vacation. I am Marjorie Egan, ably assisted here by Peter Kazis from WGBH, and Steve Morantz, longtime writer for the Boston Globe, now works for ESPN, and he's just written himself a spectacular, heartwarming and tough at the same time, new book called Next Up at Fenway, A Story of High School, Hope, and, okay, help me.
Lindos Sueños.
Thank you very much. That's the voice of Steve Morantz. And Peter Kazis is here with us.
Steve, I was fascinated by the book, and this is actually a great opportunity because Fenway High, which is the backdrop and the subject of your book, is a school that both my wife and I are very interested in having our soon-to-be eighth grader attend when he graduates in a year. If he were to go there, if he were lucky enough to get in, what would he find? What's it like there?
It's a great school. And I hope he is lucky enough to go there. They get 800 applicants every year, and they choose 80. It's one of the unknown gems of the Boston system. You hear a lot about the problems in the Boston system. A lot of the reporting is on the difficulties in the system. Fenway High is one of the success stories.
But what makes it work? Well, same question. Yeah.
Small size. But mostly it's the theory behind the school. It goes back to Ted Sizer, who was the dean of the Harvard Graduate School of Education. He created something called the Essential School. Longer class periods, narrow but deep curriculum. They have an emphasis on social values and social conscience. Character. They teach character. And it's a school where the kids learn how to present and write. And they learn critical thinking, most importantly, critical thinking.
And is this a charter school? Is this an innovation school? Is this a what school?
It is not. It is a Boston Public School pilot school.
Pilot school,
pilot.
Okay.
Which was,
so that means it's run by Boston Public School teachers, but they don't have the union rules.
They have different union rules. This was something Mayor Menino created back in the mid-90s to compete with charter schools.
Okay.
Now, how important is the principal, is the leadership here? Reading your book, I got the impression that she is the driving force
here.
She
is. She's Peggy Kemp is the headmaster.
That's right.
Peggy's a graduate of the Harvard School of Law, but she decided she liked education better than law. She has a very wise and firm touch in guiding the school. The faculty adores her. The excellence of the school starts right at the top.
What was it about this? You know, this isn't a nationally known school. I mean, outside of education circles. What prompted you to do a book about this?
You know,
a terrific book, by the way.
I've been a Red Sox fan forever, and I've been a reporter in Boston forever, and I've seen that high school, and I always wondered, what's it like to go to high school next to a, you know, an iconic ballpark?
Because you can see Fenway. You can see it
sure.
Right out the windows, different views of Fenway Park.
Yeah. You can. And the Ted Williams teammate statue on at Gate B, Ted Williams is looking right at...
Yeah, you walk out the door. I mean, my old office used to be right by there.
So it turns out Peggy introduced me to five students. Two of them were crazy about baseball. They were Latino kids who went to Fenway High because it was a good school, but they also liked the fact that it was next to the ballpark. And whereas most of the faculty discounts the location as kind of irrelevant, it turns out that it's not exactly irrelevant. It is kind of inspirational to the kids who buy into baseball, and they have a good high school baseball program.
Well, you focus on this one kid, Marco Baez,
yeah.
who had a very tough childhood, single mom, dad not in the picture, went to, for whatever reason, all these different elementary schools.
Yep.
And then he arrives at Fenway.
He arrives at Fenway, and he's 15 years old, and he's thinking, my family's struggling. If I can make a career in baseball, you know, maybe I can help my family. So, you know, that's the mindset he has at 15, but Fenway goes to work on him, and it works its magic, and it finds in Marcos a excellent student, a tremendous writer. That's what caught my attention. He wrote a short story as a sophomore that's called The Disobedient Child. His college application essay was based on a trip he took to the Dominican Republic, sponsored by the Red Sox Foundation, and that was the Lindo Sueños program. And what he saw on that trip formed the basis for his college application essay, and it's beautifully written.
Where do you go to college?
He's at Holy Cross. He just finished his second year.
Good for him.
And
that's a tough school to get into.
It is. He got a full scholarship. He's one of the success stories. He's working this summer as an intern for Senator Sonia Chang Diaz.
Good for him.
Now, what happens? The school slated to move to Mission Hill.
Yeah, this is something. This is in the epilogue. Something that happened after I did my reporting. But they wanted to expand Fenway to more students. They want to expand from 300 to 440 students, and they decided to move it over to Mission Hill. But actually, this was a real estate deal that City Hall had to do.
We're talking with Steve Morantz, who's got a great new book out talking about this young man who goes to Fenway High School and with a tough life and succeeds and manages to go to Holy Cross. You just heard him say that. And you talked at the beginning when you first came on that there's 800 kids that applied for admission to Fenway High, 80 get in. We look at this morning's Globe. It talks about the half the seats being empty in Boston high schools. So obviously there's something that's working. The disasters of public schools have been well documented. They're terrible in the inner cities, even in Boston, which is not exactly an inner city. I mean, we're a small city, but they're struggling here. The Burke is struggling here. English High School is struggling here. So why does this school work? Is it because they're going from 8 in the morning to late in the afternoon? Is it because they can do these different programs?
All of that. In 2008, the Gaston Institute at UMass Boston recognized Fenway as a school where Latinos succeed. There are only two high schools in the city that got that recognition.
Because they have a very tough record, the Latino kids.
And the school's now like 46-47% Latino.
What's the other school?
The other school in that report, I don't know right
now. Okay.
Okay,
we'll sorry,
forgive
that,
you.
That's
you
not,
should have
yeah.
known that, Steve Morantz.
I should. But it's a very Latino-friendly culture. They have Latino groups, after-school groups. They have a great course called Spanish for Native Speakers, where kids grow up with Spanish in the home, but they don't. They need help with reading and writing and Spanish identity, culture, and so forth. So, and they have a tremendous teacher there. Her name's Lisette Castillo. She was born in the Dominican, but she was educated at English High, and she's a driving force at the school. They have a tremendous faculty, committed, stable. They don't mind getting close with the kids. They give out their cell phone numbers to the parents. Why the Latino kids like it is because it replicates the feeling of family. And in the Latino culture, family is first.
Yeah.
It sounds like you were embedded in the school. How did you tell us how you went about reporting the book?
Okay, that's a good question. I approached the headmaster, Peggy Kemp, and laid out my idea for a story. And she was open to it, invited me in, and introduced me to teachers and basically gave me the run of the school. I could sit in on any classes. She introduced me to 5 students who kept journals for me during their year. In fact, the last chapter, the last part of the book is the final journal entry of Marcos Baez after he graduated. 3 weeks after he went back to the school and went up to the library and sat down and wrote what was in his heart. And it turned out that he'd had a sad crush, love affair, and unrequited. And so he wrote about it. But typical of Marcos, he wrote it beautifully. And when I saw it, I said, that's it. That's the last chapter.
So what's the takeaway here, Steve Morantz? I mean, that more schools should be modeled on the Fenway High School for Latino kids, for any kids?
Sure, if you can do
it. I mean, this is what we're getting to, is it not? An education reform that the public school is getting out at 2 o'clock in the afternoon with the old school rules are not working anymore.
That's true. I mean, I think they are trying to replicate Fenway. The Boston Green Academy in South Boston is built on the Fenway model, but it's only 2 years old, so it's a little early to tell. I think, you know, the takeaway is, you know, it's one student at a time. Marco succeeded. You can have these vast mega macro plans, but when you come down to it, it's one teacher, one student. And try to make the best of it.
Let me run a theory past you, Steve. I mean, I've had my kids went through the Boston public school system. I have 2 who are still in it. And what has struck me is the schools that have this effect on kids, on boys and girls, have dynamic principals. Now, these principals are all very different. They're not the principals aren't cookie cutters.
Right.
If we could go from the specifics of Fenway High and the specifics of the principal, but to try to step back a bit, how important do you think, as someone who's reported a lot on this, is the on-site leadership?
It's tremendously important. But if you're asking me how can you guarantee that the principal's always going to be as good as Peggy Kemp, That's like asking the Red Sox to guarantee every free agent they acquire is going to be not going to be, you know, Carl Crawford or something.
No.
You know, I don't know how you guarantee it. It's an art. Education's an art. It's not a hard science.
And also, a lot of these schools, I mean, I'm a big charter school fan. I mean, a lot of them don't do that well, but a lot of them do well. And you see that a lot of the teachers at these charter schools are really smart, came from a great education, yeah. And they're really smart themselves, and they're really young and enthusiastic. And maybe the model is going to change where a lot more has to be asked of teachers.
You know,
pay them a ton of money if they're great. That's my theory.
There is all the momentum now is in favor of charter schools. Yeah. That seems to be the nostrum, you know, the panacea. I mean, that's sort of a macro political socio theory.
Yeah.
I mean, if you spent some time in Fenway, you would probably say to yourself, it doesn't matter if it's charter or pilot. It's just if you give them enough local autonomy to do their thing, and you have smart people there, you have dedicated teachers, and you have a smart, dedicated headmaster, it'll get done.
Did the headmaster have to go back and have the one from Harvard Law School have to go back and get her teaching degree before she could be the principal of the school?
I don't, you know, before she...
I bet she didn't.
I think the Harvard Law degree was...
Good.
She grew up in central Kentucky, and she attended segregated elementary schools.
Wow.
When she was a kid. And she was the only African-American graduate in her 1965 class at Shepherdsville High School in Kentucky. She's a tremendous story.
Now, Peter Kansas mentioned at the beginning of the discussion, Steve Morantz, that his son would like to go to Fenway High. You have written a book that's done a great job for Fenway High. Do you think maybe you could put in a word here?
Margie, even if I was going to ask that, I wouldn't do it on the air. Is this transparency okay. Here at WGBH?
Too late now. Steve Morantz.
Very subtle,
Margie. Don't ask that.
Okay, I'm sorry. It's too late now. I've already asked. Well, let's hope they weren't listening, and they'll never know if the word is given by Steve Morantz. Anyway, Steve Morantz wrote for many years for the Boston Globe. Now he works for ESPN E60. By the way, before you go, what is E60 for those of us who aren't sports?
It's a news magazine
show. Okay, news magazine. I should know that. I don't know enough about sports. His new book is called Next Up at Fenway, A Story of High School Hope and...
Lindos Sueños.
Thank you very much, Steve Morantz, for being with us. Up next, Elena Zubareva talks about her role in the new Brad Pitt zombie movie, World War Z, and also why a song written by a Russian, the 1812 Overture, has become the theme for every July 4th celebration in America. That conversation is next. Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
President's on the road, and so are we. The Aspen Ideas Festival is underway. We are packing our bags and heading to the Rockies. We'll ask about the big ideas in education and learning. We'll hear from a diverse group of movers and shakers, including you, on our live Twitter chat. Use the hashtag NPRAspen and join us next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs exist because of you and the Westin Copley Place. You can relax in their newly renovated guest rooms overlooking Back Bay and the Charles River. More information and details at westincopleyplaceboston.com/SIC. And Ferguson Bath Kitchen and Lighting Gallery, featuring the latest for your kitchen and bath, including KitchenAid appliances offering designs to complement all lifestyles. Locations at ferguson.com.
Okay, you may be wondering why we're hearing the 1812 Overture, because I am now informed in a way that I never was before by the 1812 Overture, and we're joined by Elena Zabareva, who has one of the extremely beautiful voices of all time. She's also a Russian, and she's going to tell us about that, the Brad Pitt movie, and a whole bunch of stuff. By the way, I should mention that Jim Brown is not here. Peter Kazis is filling in. Hello, Elena.
Hello, guys. So nice to see you again.
Well, I did not even think about it. Of course, we've heard the 1812 Overture at every 4th of July celebration for a long time. Never thought it was written by Tchaikovsky. I never thought about that.
Not only that, so it is written by Tchaikovsky, and it is written not about the American war with British, which happened in 1812. It is written to commemorate Russian victory over Napoleon. As you know, Napoleon was a mighty warrior who conquered so many countries, and in 1812, he invaded Russia. But we soundly and resolutely beat him, defeated, and got him out of our country and chased him actually back all the way to Paris. And then, because it was such an important victory, people, particularly people in Moscow, decided to build a cathedral in honor of that victory. And it was eventually built in 1882. And for that particular opening, Tchaikovsky was commissioned to write an overture. That is why, when you listen to it, you hear parts of La Marseillaise, which is the French national anthem, as well as parts of Russian national anthem, God Save the Tsar.
I didn't know that.
Yep. But the piece is, of course, very beautiful. And yes, it was premiered in 1882 for the grand opening of the Cathedral of Jesus Christ the Savior, which is in Moscow, right across Kremlin. And it was a beautiful building. And when you go inside the building, there were names of all the officers and soldiers killed in that war against Napoleon.
But now finish the story about what happened to the cathedral, because I read this before. And by the way, I did not introduce you correctly because I misplaced my paper. It's Elena is an opera singer, vocal coach, and the creator of Fit Voice, a program designed to analyze people's voices for best use. Okay.
Now Marjorie, you're the best.
Finish telling us the story about the cathedral. What happened to it?
In the 30s, Stalin, who, as we know, was very much against religion and against Orthodox faith, he decided to demolish the cathedral. My late uncle, who lived in Moscow at the time, told me that people of Moscow were standing on their knees for 3 days around the cathedral, begging the government not to do that. But Stalin had absolutely demonic plan. He wanted to demolish the cathedral and build instead a so-called Palace of the Soviets, where the government would have moved from Kremlin, and that would have been the new era, the new center for this red, you know, communist regime. But what happened was, so they did demolish the cathedral, and I saw the documentary about it. It was traumatic. But then, when they tried to build their stupid palace, they actually got water, some flooding from the nearby underground river. Now, notice how heavy the cathedral was, and water never intervened, but it intervened with their plans to build a palace.
So it kept flooding?
Yes, it kept flooding no matter what they do. And you can imagine how important that project was.
Right.
How many people were actually involved, very high, you know, engineers and all other people. They couldn't do anything. So at the end, very embarrassed, government decided to give up and instead build a pool.
A swimming pool.
and I actually saw it. It was the most surreal thing, this huge, open swimming pool right across Kremlin. Total bizarre. But then in 1990, people of Moscow decided, what if we'll try to rebuild the cathedral? Now, of course, everybody said, well, you know, it's absolutely impossible. First of all, because it's very expensive. Secondly, because the flooding. What can we do? But people decided, you know, we're going to try. And basically every Russian family donated some money to this project. And in 10 years, the cathedral was rebuilt. And no flooding intervened, which I think is an absolute miracle. And
then there you go.
In August...
Say your prayers.
Exactly. Yeah, I do believe it. In August 2000, the cathedral was opened. And actually, my mom and I were both invited to be a guest for that grand opening. And again, the Tchaikovsky piece was played. And again, when you walk there, and it is a beautiful, beautiful building, and it is exactly the way it was before the Stalin's horrible thing.
What a great story that is. That's the voice of Elena Zabareva, and she is, as I said before, opera singer, vocal coach. So, okay, we now have the 1812 Overture, which you thought was a little weird, right, that it was at all these July 4th celebrations. Let's hear the climactic crescendo, whatever you call it, the ultimate moment of the 1812. Here.
After which I can explain why we do it.
Okay, here it is. God.
Now, what the listeners couldn't see was Marjorie conducting. And
I
have to tell you, it was a sight.
They call me Arthur Fiedlerette.
But look, there is a story behind why this is played every 4th of July. It goes back before our recent memory. First of all, Tchaikovsky had a special relationship with Boston music lovers.
Yes.
His Piano Concerto No. 1 had its world premiere here.
Yep.
And the Boston classical music audience tended to favor French and Russian composers over the Germans. But let's flash ahead. That Arthur Fiedler, the great head of the Boston Pops, was concerned that not as many people were coming to the Pops. But a confluence of events. You had the bicentennial, you had Arthur Fiedler, and then you had David Bugar, who was one of the great philanthropists of Boston. Yep. I mean, he built part of WGBH
there.
And it was Mugar and Fiedler used to chase fires together. They'd drive around the city with their radios and they'd watch Sparks. I couldn't remember the name. And so it was their brainstorm that came up.
Yeah, in 1974.
Yep. During the bicentennial. So it's not that crazy. It wasn't a Russian plot, Marjorie.
I never even thought about it, Elena, until I knew I was talking to you today. And I thought, it is weird when you think about it because it's in Boston, it's in Philadelphia, it's all over the country.
I saw the first one. I saw it from the Cambridge side of the river. I climbed a tree. Anyone looking at me today would say, yeah, I can't imagine that. I climbed a tree. I was with, the Hirshhorns, Paul Hirshhorn.
Oh, yes.
I climbed a tree and not way up, and I watched the whole thing from across, and it was unbelievable. And all the bells in the Back Bay, the Church of the Advent and Beacon Hill, all the bells in the city rang. And that first one was very moving. I used to play Toy Soldiers to that. No, as a little kid, we would put it on over and over and drive my mother crazy.
And we'd have all
our soldiers set up in the living room.
Oh, that's adorable. That's adorable. Okay, now we have the answer to that. Now, one of the things we wanted to talk to you about, you were originally cast in the new Brad Pitt blockbuster, World War Z, the zombie movie. We talked about this last week with Christopher Lydon, the zombies trying to take over the whole world. So tell us about that. You were cast in the movie. What happened?
Well, I was cast in a movie, and they did film me. But then they decided, actually, Paramount Pictures bosses decided, after they saw the director's cut, that the ending, the last 40 minutes of the movie, wouldn't work. And the reason was because we, at the end, had the most climatic, frightening battle, which was supposed to be the conclusion of the movie. But the Paramount people said, not for the record, but I will tell you, that they couldn't even see Brad Pitt's character amongst these piles of bodies and blood and all this destruction, and it's a little bit too much. And so they, in almost unprecedented move in Hollywood, decided to rewrite and refilmed the last 40 minutes, which was really huge, and everybody was upset and confused. But that's what they did. And the budget skyrocketed to some crazy number. But nevertheless, that's what they did.
What was your part, though? You were singing, I presume.
Yes. What happened was, that last part was happening in Russia. Of course, it was filmed in Budapest, but it was happening in Russia in winter, where Brad Pitt's character, Jerry, and a few Russian survivors were there trying to fight the zombies. By that point, zombies pretty much conquered the entire world. And then Brad Pitt's character somehow discovered that zombies get attracted to sounds and to voices. And that is how my character was called Russian Singer, was
Russian
asked...
Singer.
Yeah, quite appropriately. So my character was asked to sing an aria as a bait to lure those zombies into the battle. So I was singing, standing up high in the window, looking more or less like an angel. They projected the silver light on me. I was singing.
Oh, nice.
And, it was beautiful. And there was this huge, crazy snowstorm. And zombies were creeping in. And then...
They were coming to you, were they?
Actually,
the
oh no, thank God. Yeah, to my voice. Yeah. But I was safely on the third floor.
Good.
Looking down. Although the director explained to me, you have to realize that now thousands of people and zombies have been slaughtered right under your eyes. So you've got to really give us some emotions, which I did. I even cried, I remember, during all of my takes. I don't remember how many takes they took, a lot. And so then I kept singing and the battle commenced. And then my aria was both inspiration and lament. And that is how this huge, huge battle started. And then, of course, it continued through the snowstorm. And it was really epic.
So what did you sing? Was it from real, or was it an opera composed for the movie? Or?
No, it was an existing piece, because when Mark Foster, the director, who actually cast me without audition, which was very surprising, but apparently he liked my recordings. So he called me and he explained to me the mood that he was trying to create. He explained to me that zombies is a personification, did I say it right?
Yes, you did.
Of all the evil and darkness that we all have inside. And at some point, it all just went outside. And you said your voice has a very interesting quality. It's beautiful and innocent at the same time. So we need a song that would remind us of everything beautiful that zombies were trying to kill and destroy. But it has to be Russian. And so I suggested two pieces. One was Rachmaninoff vocalese, and one was Rimsky-Korsakov art song. And he asked me to sing both. Later, he was about to decide which one would be used. But they filmed me doing both songs. And I think it was really, really beautiful, not only because I was there, but also because his vision, I think, was amazing. But apparently the power of star is so huge, and apparently Brad Pitt has to be always in
now,
the center.
Now, is it against the rules for you to sing us a couple of bars?
From this, from
one
of the songs?
Yeah.
No, it's not by now, because according to my contract, I can't do anything. But, you know, these pieces are so dark. What if I'll just sing a little bit from the very famous aria that everybody knows?
We've got a minute left. Sing a little bit from the famous aria that everybody knows.
But, of course, you have to then guess what it is.
Okay.
О, мио бабино коро, вибо чебе and so forth.
La Traviata.
No. It's actually written by Puccini. It's called O mio bambino caro. It's from opera Gianni Schicchi.
Oh, no, I guess wrong again. I was sure it was La Traviata.
But it's similar. It is similar tune.
Yeah. Elena, thank you so much for being with us today. And thank you for telling us about the 1812 overture. And thank you for allowing me to guess wrong on La Traviata. Elena is an opera singer and a vocal coach. She was also originally cast in World War Z. And she is the creator of Fit Voice, a program designed to analyze people's voices for best use. Thank you very much, Elena. You have a spectacular voice.
Thank
that was
you so
wonderful.
Much, guys. Thank you.
Thank you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Thank you, Peter Kazis, for filling in for Jim Browdy. You can follow us on Twitter at Boston Public Radio, at Jim Browdy, at Marjorie Egan. You can find us on the web at wgbhnews.org/BPR. Our show is a production production of WGBH Radio. Tomorrow we get Charlie Baker. We've got Wendy Murphy talking about the Aaron Hernandez case and a lot more. So please stay tuned again tomorrow. And thank you for staying tuned today. I'm Marjorie Egan.
And I'm Peter Kansas.
Thanks for tuning in.